think magnitude can work against us sometimes, and the earthquake on Sunday is a good example of this.
Scientists put a number on Sunday's earthquake, but it's far from perfect. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 25th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, mushers report the earthquake created a mud geyser on Flathorn Lake.
Big cracks in the ice, the water shot up through, bringing with it rocks and mud and dirt from the bottom of the lake.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Your household income and the size of your family might qualify you for savings on your health care costs. You have until Sunday, January 31st, to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Call 1-844-PLANS-AK. That's 1-844-752-6725 to find local assistance in your area. There's more information online at getcoveredalaska.com. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
After an earthquake hits, like the one that struck Cook Inlet Sunday morning, everyone wants to know how big it was. Scientists use the Richter scale to describe the magnitude of an earthquake. Getting to that number, though, is a complicated process, and it has some major limitations in understanding the impact of each earthquake event. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
6.4, 7.3, 6.8. Those are all Richter scale measurements federal and state agencies published following Sunday's earthquake. It was confusing. What was the right number? State seismologist Michael West says, in a way, they were all correct.
So you got one sensor over here that records some shaking. One sensor in another direction records a whole lot of shaking. Some other sensor in a different direction, not so much. And there are different weighting schemes and location schemes that are trying to put all of those pieces of information together into a single solution.
The seismic signal from a magnitude 7 earthquake registers across the globe. After an earthquake like Sunday's, scientists are watching the data as it comes in. Then they actually get on the phone from the Alaska Earthquake Center, USGS, and the Tsunami Warning Center to figure out the definitive magnitude. Wes says in about an hour, that process is complete. But he says the agencies want to get the initial information out much more quickly.
We live in an era where 30 seconds, actually in many cases, the first indication of an earthquake might actually come from Twitter. Twitter can travel faster than that couple miles per second of seismic waves. People want information and they want to know what's going on.
So instead of one final Richter scale number, agencies release preliminary magnitude numbers. Wes says computers at the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks, where he works, at first pegged the quake at 7.3. USGS sent out a tweet with a preliminary magnitude of 6.4. When the scientists talked about the data, Wes says it didn't take long to agree on the final number of 7.1.
What people are seeing, they're getting a glimpse into the inner workings of the system. And as more data comes in, as that magnitude and location and depth are improved and evolve, people are getting to see that.
Wes says the actual Richter scale is hardly in use anymore, but scientists calibrate their other size measurements to essentially mimic that scale so they can maintain a universal standard. They need a way to easily compare the size of earthquakes. But Wes says the magnitude measurement is far from perfect.
I think magnitude can work against us sometimes, and the earthquake on Sunday is a good example of this.
Wes says the earthquake was a long way from Anchorage, 150 miles and far underneath the surface of the earth. He fears people will walk away from the experience and think they understand what a magnitude 7 earthquake feels like.
Had that earthquake occurred at the surface of the earth, close to Anchorage or Homer or somewhere else, the outcome would have been completely different.
Wes says the Alaska Earthquake Center has 30 seismic monitors in Anchorage, and they picked up dramatically different amounts of shaking in different neighborhoods. He says that information is much more useful.
I would love to see people calling, demanding more information about what was my shaking, as opposed to just how big was the earthquake.
Because at the end of the day, he says, how the earth moves in your area is much more important than the number that makes the headlines. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
It appears public infrastructure damage from the Sunday earthquake was limited to a small stretch of road on the Kenai Peninsula. State Department of Roads spokeswoman Shannon McCarthy says a 150-foot section of Kalifornsky Beach Road dropped about 18 inches in the northbound lane. Crews today began removing the pavement from both lanes along that section. They'll then bring gravel to fill in the gaps and level it off, and that work will take another day or two. A neighborhood in Kenai was evacuated after a fire and explosions caused by a natural gas leak following the earthquake. As KDLL's Jenny Nyman reports, four homes were destroyed in that fire.
An emergency shelter was set up at the Kenai National Guard Armory. Sergeant First Class Albert Burns got the phone call from the Kenai Peninsula Borough's Office of Emergency Management.
They called me at 3 o'clock this morning and said we have people displaced. And I go, okay, I'll be there in 15 minutes. I'd already been awake because of the earthquake. And as soon as I got the call and when Dan said his name, it was like, okay, I knew what was going on. This isn't the first time I've had to do this.
By mid-morning, about 45 evacuees had been through the shelter. From Lilac Lane, Cook Inlet View Drive, and Wells Way, with that number growing to 60 by the end of the day, Kenai police officers came by regularly to give updates. By 10:30 a.m., Lieutenant David Ross reported that the fires were under control.
There's still a problem with the natural gas there. NSTAR's got lots of equipment there and lots of people there. The gas is bubbling out of the ground in some places, so it's still not a safe place to return to. The gas is shut off to the neighborhood, so that should dissipate, and the fires are just about out. That's the good news part of it.
All residents of the four burned homes got out safely, with only one person sustaining mild burns. Pets were not so lucky, as there hadn't been time to do anything but grab family members and run. Janice Gottschalk lives with her fiancé, brother, and three kids, ages 9 to 12, at 1211 Lilac.
About 1:30, the earthquake hit, and probably about 1:40, 1:45, I heard my neighbor's house blow up. Her gas blew off the roof. They thankfully made out. And then we were all told probably about 5 minutes later to evacuate our house as well.
They went to a friend's apartment across the street and waited with a dozen people while fire crews attempted to contain the fire. A little before 3 a.m., fire personnel smelled gas leaking at the east end of the street and evacuated more of the neighborhood. Another explosion damaged a second home, and the flames spread.
We made it out with everything on our backs. Our house is a complete and total loss. But I'm thanking God that we made it out, thanks to the fire department and the police department.
The American Red Cross took over operation of the shelter by Sunday afternoon and would help find temporary housing for the families that couldn't return home. Lilac Lane offers mostly lower-cost housing for people with limited means. Gottschalk doesn't know what her family will do in the immediate future, but has already been amazed at the support from businesses and individuals in the community.
I'm from Anchorage, and I'm not used to this. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And down here, it's so close-knit, and I'm just really overwhelmed and shocked right now.
Renee Duncan of Soldotna heard about the evacuations early Sunday morning and began calling businesses to secure donations.
Went and gathered up a bunch of different stuff from them and brought it over. So I'm just going to spend time today and see if I can help out with anything.
Around 2 p.m., Kenai police opened Cook Inlet View Drive and Wells Way to residents, but closed the streets again around 3 p.m. due to elevated gas levels. NSTAR was on scene all day working to contain the leaks. By 10 p.m., NSTAR reported its crews had completed repairs and were in the process of turning gas back on in the area. In Kenai, I'm Jenny Nyman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a first-time filmmaker takes her tattoo documentary to the Sundance Institute.
And really, the film isn't just about tattooing, it's about being a proud Native person, proud of your history and your family and your culture.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Miller Energy Resources has agreed to pay $5 million to settle allegations that it inflated the value of its Alaska oil and gas properties by more than $400 million. The Peninsula Clarion reports the January 12th settlement brings an end to a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission investigation into the parent company of Cook Inlet Energy. The SEC charged Miller Energy and three officials of fraudulently inflating the values of the company's Alaska properties beginning in January of 2010. The company later purchased the properties for $2.25 million in 2009 and later reported them at a value of $480 million. The company filed for bankruptcy protection in October. As part of the settlement, the company has agreed to unregister all of its stocks and provide employees to testify about the violations. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the Senate Energy Committee, gave the Republican Weekly address this weekend. She used the opportunity to talk about the Energy Modernization Bill she co-sponsored with the top Democrat on her committee. That's Maria Cantwell of Washington State. Murkowski says the energy world has changed a lot since 2007, when the last such bill passed Congress.
It's been over 8 years, folks. Back then, we were living in an era of energy scarcity, with many afraid that America was running out of resources.
The fracking revolution changed all of that, and Murkowski says U.S. policy needs to change too.
On top of that, the cost of many other technologies, from solar panels to batteries for electric vehicles, has declined dramatically.
Murkowski says the bill will help bring electricity policy into the modern age. Congress is off to a delayed start this week due to the big snowstorm that immobilized much of the East Coast over the weekend. When senators return to take up bills, the energy bill is at the top of their agenda. A U.S. Senate committee passed language last week that would preemptively block a draft of a Fish and Wildlife Service rule seeking to ban some predator control in national wildlife refuges. The proposed rule change is the latest in a long-running tug-of-war between the state and the feds over how to manage wildlife in Alaska. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports.
In an Environment and Public Works hearing Wednesday morning, Senator Dan Sullivan introduced an amendment to a bill saying Fish and Wildlife can't implement a recently proposed rule restricting management practices in Alaska refuges.
These proposed regulations, as currently written by the Fish and Wildlife Service, would fundamentally alter not only how we now manage wildlife refugees and the fish and wildlife and habitats on them, but will also change the relationship of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the individual states from one of cooperation, which it should be, to subservience.
Fish and Wildlife manages nearly 77 million acres of land in Alaska in 16 national wildlife refuges. The practices that Fish and Wildlife intends to ban in those areas are what the state calls intensive management, like baiting brown bears, same-day airborne hunting of bears, and harvesting wolves and coyotes during denning season. Susan Alexander is manager for the Alaska Peninsula and Basharoff National Wildlife Refuges. She says the state has used intensive management in management units that overlap with 13 of the 16 refuges.
What it means is that the state in those areas is focusing on practices to reduce predator populations, to increase the availability of certain species, mostly moose and caribou, for harvest by people. And that involves some specific targeted control of predators that are practices that are counter to our mandates.
Fish and Wildlife is federally mandated to manage for biological integrity and environmental health in refuges.
And then within ANILCA, each of the Alaska refuges has a purpose, which is to manage for natural diversity.
Also within ANILCA is Title VIII, which gives Alaska Natives and rural residents priority for subsistence hunting. Then on the state side, the Alaska Board of Game has its own constitutional mandate to manage wildlife for the benefit of all citizens. This clutter of legal frameworks has created confusion and sometimes contention going back two decades. Here, conservationists support the federal restrictions. Hunters, however, and the state of Alaska and its congressional delegation view each proposal as another example of federal overreach.
Both sides are making laws to help protect what they got, and the users are stuck in between.
Frank Wood is chairman of the Nooshogak Fish and Game Advisory Committee and spent years working on subsistence issues with the Bristol Bay Native Association. He reminds people that what's really at stake for local users is big game that wolves and bears prey on.
When I first got into resource management for subsistence use at BB&A, we had 7 established wolf packs in Bristol Bay, and they decimated the caribou population, but also decimating the calving population on moose in the spring and in the wintertime.
Last year, the National Park Service took the lead on predator control hunting restrictions, finalizing similar rules for park and preserve lands in October 2015. The Fish and Wildlife Service, which generally manages for much more liberal hunting practices on refuge lands, let NPS test the waters before moving forward with its own rule. Sullivan's amendment to stop that rule passed the committee Wednesday by a vote of 12-8. It'll be added to the Bipartisan Sportsmen's Act of 2015, which heads next to the U.S. Senate. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Denali National Park and 2 conservation groups are asking the Alaska Board of Game to consider proposals aimed at better protecting park wolves. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the proposals are not currently in line for review until next year.
Denali National Park Chief of Resources Dave Schierichauer says the park's proposal would eliminate overlap of state spring wolf hunting and bear baiting seasons along the park's northeast boundary.
We do know that 2 members of the East Fork Pack were harvested in association with a bear baiting station last spring.
Schierichauer says the deaths are likely why Denali's once popularly viewed East Fork Pack did not den this past spring, an issue given that the park's overall wolf population is at an all-time low of fewer than 50 animals. The hunting season adjustment is more modest than what the Alaska Wildlife Alliance and Denali Citizens Council are seeking. DCC Secretary Nancy Bale describes a proposal which would ban wolf harvest on a swath of state land along the park's northeast boundary.
Set aside an area that includes the Wolf Townships and the Nenana Canyon area, which are areas where wolves take forays outside the park.
The Game Board eliminated an earlier wolf buffer zone in 2010 and imposed a 6-year moratorium on consideration of Denali wolf proposals. That's set to end, but Bale says a change to the regional meeting schedule means further delay.
Last year, the Board of Game changed their cycle of meetings from every 2 years to every 3 years as a cost-saving measure.
The sponsors of both Denali wolf proposals are requesting that the Game Board consider them out of cycle at a statewide March meeting in Fairbanks. The board will consider the agenda change requests plus 5 others related to different issues during a teleconference meeting Friday afternoon at 3. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska Attorney General Craig Richards announced a new public integrity unit Friday that's aimed at improving trust in government, rather. He says the unit will focus on shootings and other cases in which law enforcement officers use force, as well as deaths in jails and prisons and allegations of corruption.
Just in a post-Ferguson world, I think in general that the public's eye is increasingly looking to make sure that officer-involved shootings are scrutinized appropriately. And we're certainly not suggesting they aren't now. This just ensures with a criminal investigator that law has its own resources to do some independent investigation.
Richard says the administration wants the public to know there's an independent unit devoted to these issues. The current budget for the Department of Law would pay for the unit. It would include 2 attorneys, a forensic auditor, an investigator, and a staff member. But the fate of the plan depends on how much money is included in the state budget. If the legislature cuts Governor Bill Walker's budget proposal, state officials would decide whether they can afford the unit at all.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
30 mushers in the Northern Lights 300 sled dog race were on the trail when a strong earthquake shook South Central Alaska on Sunday morning. Mushers in the race were either on their way back to the Big Lake finish line or resting at checkpoints at the time of the quake. Race manager Sue Allen credits a quick-thinking trail-breaking team for rerouting the course around dangerous cracks and fissures in the ice on the Big Susitna River caused by the 7.1 jolt.
Pretty much at that point, everybody was on one of the rivers somewhere. And our point riders who go out ahead of the teams to make sure everything is okay, when they got back here to the kennel, they had some unbelievable pictures and stories of just huge cracks and jumbled ice and fissures and water on the ice that they came across on the river. And they were able to reroute the trail around all of those.
Allen says mushers witnessed an unusual geyser-like effect when crossing Flathorn Lake on the trail.
And every musher that finishes told us the same thing. It must have just been a big mud geyser with everything coming up from the bottom of the lake. Big cracks in the ice, the water shot up through, bringing with it rocks and mud and dirt from the bottom of the lake. And so where those cracks were, everybody said the same thing. It was like a river of dirt and rocks, almost like somebody had gone out and just sprinkled them.
All race competitors made it to the Big Lake finish line safely. Ryan Reddington is the winner. Reddington arrived back at Big Lake at 9:30 Sunday morning with a total run time of 44 hours, 38 minutes, and 15 seconds. There's no money purse for the race, so Reddington wins a pair of golden collars donated by High's Adventure Gear. The Northern Lights 300 Trail starts in Big Lake and turns around at Finger Lakes at the foot of the Alaska Range. Three mushers scratched this year out of an original lineup of 33 who started the race on Friday. A lot of Alaskans may know Inupiaq artist Holly Nordlum as a graphic designer, jewelry maker, and creator of art that provokes conversations about the painful history of organized religion's impacts on Native people. Born in Kotzebue, Nordlum is a powerhouse of ideas and creative energy. Recently, her desire to get a traditional Inupiaq chin tattoo led her on a journey of searching for a tattooist who could teach the ancient cultural art of tattooing with ink and thread or skin poking. She worked with other artists and her partner, Greenlandic Inuit Maya Jakobsen, through a Polar Lab program at the Anchorage Museum. They made a short film about their quest, and Nordlum decided that there was more to tell. So the first-time filmmaker set out to produce a documentary. She tells APRN's Lori Townsend she applied to the Sundance Institute's Native American and Indigenous program and was accepted.
I was super excited, obviously. Having the Sundance name behind your film, behind your project, is huge for a film.
Especially for a first film.
First film. First time producer, first time director, first time writer, right? That said, I've been doing the arts for 20 years, professionally for 10. It's not like I'm a newbie, but definitely taking a big chance on me. Very exciting. Get to go to all these Sundance films, but also to the events and the receptions. And, you know, we're going to do a lot of press, and that's all really exciting. You know, just to make sure I'm promoting as much as I can about the film, but also about other Alaskan Native artists while I'm there. It's a big opportunity for us as a group of contemporary artists also.
Have you worked out the full concept of what the film will be? Tell us about what exactly you're planning and what the film will try to accomplish.
Well, we've decided on Tupik. The tattoo program through the museum is called Tupik Mi, Tattoo People. Tupik will be the name of the film, and Tupik means tattoo in Inupiaq. The film itself will be about Maya and I and our struggle through this, but also about people's perceptions of face tattooing, and it'll be interesting to get a pro and con, and we're going to do a little bit with the family, but also the training program is a big part of this, and really the film isn't just about tattooing, it's about being a proud Native person, proud Aleut, proud Inupiaq, proud Tlingit person, you know, it's being proud and wearing that proudly, so really that's what the goal of the program and the film will be, proud of your history and your family and your culture.
At one time, Native people of the North, and I'm not sure if it was Inupiaq or Yupik or who, also had ivory plugs.
Yes, so beautiful.
Has anyone talked about also going back to doing some of that?
Absolutely. I mean, with tattooing, there's a lot, too, with the inks and the methods. But then we've also talked about that. I mean, I have big dreams of going back to all of that. You know, there is an artist who had plugs put in, but he had them done at a shop. So then looking at that traditionally and how that transpired is very interesting. And we run across that and we kind of keep that material for future because this isn't a small project for us. I consider this I'm lucky enough to make this part of my life, this promoting traditional tattooing and being a proud Native person, working with students, working with adults. And I feel like I'm lucky to be able to do this.
So you leave for Sundance soon. What's the timeline then after the big, wonderful festival? Then the actual work gets started. So what are you looking at for a timeline for when you think the film will actually be ready to be out?
We've actually done some filming. We went to New Zealand for an all-Indigenous conference. And then when Maya was here for the kickoff program with the museum, we also did filming then. So we've already started. Really, I want to come up with a more concrete plan to where to go from here and make the best quality film I can. And we figure that'll take 2 years. So I'm hoping November-ish 2018 we'll have some kind of product. That's my end date, my hopeful goal.
Inupiaq artist Holly Nordlum is in Park City, Utah this week learning from a stellar line of filmmakers. She spoke with APRN's Lori Townsend. Links to her short video are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jenny Nyman in Kenai, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Locke here, and Lori Townsend here in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Mr. Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaskans across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The last day to sign up during open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace is Sunday, January 31st. Depending on your income and household size, you may qualify for savings. Be informed. Call 1-844-PLANS-AK. That's 1-844-752-6725 to find local assistance in your area. More information online at getcoveredalaska.com. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.